Greetings and welcome to Mind Matters News. I'm your host, Robert J. Marks. We've been talking to Major General Bobby Hollingsworth about his life and views, and he's a retired Major General from the United States Marines, where he did things like fly fighter planes, and I want to talk about that. Bob, how did you get started down the path of becoming a fighter pilot? I do know that you have an undergraduate degree in electrical engineering from, where is it?
The old war school.
The old war school.
They can't call it that anymore because that's politically incorrect, because the name came from where all the people that was going to school joined one of the fights that occurred. And it was the wrong one.
I remember they used to call it the War Department in the United States. And now it's the Department of Defense. They had to change it to the police. It sounds a lot better than the Department of War as opposed to the Department of Defense. So you got your degree in electrical engineering. You wanted to be a pilot since you was a little kid, right?
2 years old.
2 years old. You actually remember that?
I remember it like it was yesterday.
Oh, what was it?
When my uncle, who was an F-6F Hellcat pilot in World War II, flew missions all over the Pacific. He came back, and I was 2 years old when he came back. He had his Navy uniform on with his wings of gold.
Okay.
And I was 2 years old, and my folks made a picture of me looking up at him, a little tow-headed, blonde-headed kid, looking up at him and just in amazement. And that day, I knew I wanted to be a fighter pilot just like him.
Really?
I knew it from then on. And so
now, that's interesting, since you were attracted by the reputation as opposed to the experience. Had you probably hadn't flown yet, right?
At 2 years old. No, I hadn't.
No, you hadn't, but it was looking up to somebody as kind of a hero, and I want to be like that.
Sure.
Okay.
You know, and it was just an inspiration to me. You know, it gave me a raison d'etre for the rest of my life, the way I planned it.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, of course, God opened a lot of doors for me as I went through this thing. But, I remember I lived out in the country. My dad, after he came back from World War II, he was a dairy farmer. And we had cows. And so
that's a hard life, man.
Every morning
you got to get up at
4:30 every morning.
4:30 in the morning. Go milk the cows.
Those cows have got to be milked twice a day.
Otherwise, they get sick, right? They get infections and all sorts of stuff.
But that was also our source of income because we bottled the milk and we delivered it. We had a milk delivery thing. Mm-hmm. And so— That's a whole nother story. But because of that, you know, those cows got to be milked twice a day. You know, so you got to be there in the morning, you got to be there in the night, and every day, 7 days a week.
No vacations.
No vacations.
Okay.
So anyway, you learn a pretty good work ethic there. You don't necessarily like what you're doing because shoveling cow poop twice a day is not the most fun thing in the world.
You know, the interesting thing is that the people I work with that have been raised on farms have the most incredible work ethic. My uncles and my father were raised on a farm. Astonishing work ethic.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing the discipline that you acquire from just having to do things on a routine basis.
Whether you like it or not.
Day after day. That's right.
Yeah.
It is what it is.
Okay.
So, but that's a whole other story about that. But, you know, we live way out in the country. We live, I like to say, we live so far out in the country that they used to have to pipe sunshine to us. Yeah. Because.
I've never heard that. Okay.
Because we lived on a dirt road. It wasn't a gravel road. When I was a kid, it was a dirt road.
Oh, yeah.
And then we got gravel on the road, and we thought, whoa, man, we've moved uptown here. And then finally, when I was about 5 or 6, they put in, REA came in and put in electrical power lines. And we had electrical power.
Yep.
Because when I was a kid, we had a well that my dad dug. We had no internal plumbing. We had an outhouse. And, you know, we took baths in a number 3 wash tub and heated on a wood stove.
Oh, we did. My grandparents lived in a similar place, and we used to have a tub, and there was this hierarchy. You know, the oldest person bathed first. The second one came in, the water was dirty. After he was done, the third one came in, it was really dirty. And then the young kid came into this tub of mud and had to take a bath. Yeah. That was similar to what you were doing?
Except there's only 4 of us.
Oh, there were only 4
of us. My mom and my dad and my sister and myself.
You know?
So it wasn't. It wasn't that bad.
So did you go through the hierarchy every time?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Mom first, dad second, me next, and then my sister next.
Okay.
So, but anyway, when we got electricity, boy, man, what a change in life. Yeah, and my grandkids don't even, they can't even relate to that, not having an indoor toilet and all that stuff.
Oh, you know? Heck, they can't relate to not having a cell phone. And I tell you, I can't relate to not having GPS. I can't relate to not having the internet. So, we just get numbed by familiarity.
Yeah, that's a whole other story about our military. We've become so dependent upon the electronics that we've lost some of the skills we need, because they aren't going to always be available.
Well, this is a little side note, but I was talking to a guy that was doing research for the Air Force, and they're worried about loss of GPS while they're flying. Because what if you lose the GPS? So they came up with technology I think was rather clever. They have stored in their computer maps. And so they have a camera, and the camera takes a picture of the terrain and does a matching with the maps inside, so they know exactly where they are. So it isn't dependent on GPS. So the military, at least I know in that sense, is aware of the necessity of pushing away from technology and doing other stuff. So,
But the thing that helped me along – from an intellectual perspective, is because we live so far in the country, we had a bookmobile. We didn't have a chance to go to the library downtown. So a bookmobile would come by once a week and we'd get books.
Okay, bookmobile, just for those of you, I don't think most of the younger listeners have been in a library in the last 5 years. Okay. I know I haven't been in a library, but you used to have to go to the library to do books. And some of the more remote places, they used to take all of the books and put them on a little kind of a truck, and they called it a bookmobile, and they would go around and they would visit people, and you could come out and you could grab a book. I mean, that concept is so foreign today. You know, it's gone like the buggy whip factory. It just doesn't exist anymore.
But what that did for me, it gave me a whole window to the world that I didn't have available to me.
Okay.
And so I read books about all kinds of things that I'd never even heard of before. And here I was in Louisiana, but I used to read books about hockey. Because I'd never heard of it. I said, what is this game? What is it about hockey that's so attractive, buddy? And I read it and I understood, what the game was. But those are the kind of things that the world got open to me a little bit as I was growing up through the bookmobile.
Okay.
And, now everybody's got a computer. And when I talk to my grandkids now, why do you need a book? You can get everything you need on a computer.
Yeah, with Kindle and all this stuff, sure.
And it's pretty phenomenal how we've come along technologically to do that, but we don't need to lose sight of the basic skills of reading a book and understanding how to use a compass and how to navigate with a compass and a map. Those are still basic skills that you got them on a computer and you don't need them, but it may not always be there.
My wife is concerned about that. I say it's on the web, it's in the cloud. You're okay. You don't have to worry about it. She says, but what if it goes away? I want a hard copy. So like our tax returns, I say, I have it on my computer. She said, no, I want a hard copy just in case we lose it.
Yeah.
So I think that there's probably some truth about that, but I wonder if it's overkill. I don't know.
Well, neither do I, but it's just something we need to be prepared for.
Sure.
And to understand that the things we have today that are given to us by the good Lord that make our lives so simple are incredible, and we should be thankful to Him every day for those things.
Yep.
But at the same time, the Lord giveth, and if the Lord takes them away, we better be ready to have some kind of a lifestyle based on that. But going back to where, following my career and how I wanted to continue to be a pilot, I used to read books all the time, about flying and so forth. And, of course, flying back in those days, that was in the early 50s, when I was growing up, and it wasn't near as sophisticated as it is today.
Uh-huh.
But at the same time, it always intrigued me. And I remember in the late 50s, when I was in high school and so forth, at Barksdale Air Force Base, which is 100 miles west of us, they had the B-36 was the big bomber at that time.
Right.
And it had pusher turboprops behind the wing. There were six engines on it.
Oh, okay.
And it would shake the earth.
It
was behind the wings.
I think I remember pictures of that. That's interesting. Yeah. What was that called again?
It was a B-36.
A B-36, okay.
Yeah. But I used to watch those things. And I don't know if kids do this anymore, but I used to lay on my back and look at the clouds and picture the formations that the clouds brought.
Okay.
I guess you'd call it dreaming. About things that you'd never seen before.
Did you think about the clouds forming shapes that were familiar in any sense? Yeah.
And there's
a great line in Hamlet where Hamlet's lying on his back and they're looking at the clouds and somebody says it looks like this. And he says, me thinks it is like a weasel. I mean, that's a famous Hamlet quote where he's looking at the clouds. So you did that. You looked at the clouds and saw pictures.
And then I would look up and see those, you could hear those B-36s coming, you know, from 30 miles away. Because they start shaking the ground.
And, oh, my gosh, and really?
It was incredible.
Yeah.
And I'd watch them come over, you know, and I would just marvel at those big silver things. You know, they were like looked like a B-29 was, you know, it's a big old silver thing.
Yeah.
And it was just beautiful. But anyway, I continued all that dreaming about all that stuff. And then when I was going to high school, the things that interested me most was physics. I never took chemistry, but physics and all the mathematics, you know, the trig and solid and on all the algebras and all that stuff.
That's good stuff.
That fascinated me.
If you have the blessing of enjoying mathematics, that stuff is incredible.
It's
so mentally satisfying.
Yeah. So then I think I told you the story earlier when I went to college, went to LSU, and the first year was you just go through what they call a junior division. You just had to take normal subjects. You had to take English. You had to take chemistry. You had to take physics. You had to take history, you know, and so forth. And then, but the second year, you had to go tell them what you wanted to do. You'd talk to a counselor and say, "I would like to," because you had to go choose your school.
That was the way I did too.
Engineering,
my undergraduate
business,
degree.
Law, whatever you wanted to do, you had to get focused in those areas. And so the counselor asked me, "What do you want to do?" I said, "I want to fly airplanes." "Well, we don't teach people to fly airplanes here. What do you want to do here at LSU?" And I said, "To fly airplanes, I have to have a piece of paper that says I'm a graduate of college."
Oh, was that right?
Yes.
And who did you take that sheet of paper to? Military or?
Well, yeah, you had to have it to the military before they would accept you as a pilot.
Gotcha.
And so I said, "All I want is that piece of paper so I can show that." Well, what do you want to study while you're here? What do you want that piece of paper to say on there? I said, that I graduated.
Okay.
I mean, that's how naive I was, I guess. But anyway, the guy says, "Well, what for airplanes? You want to fly airplanes? Why don't you go down and talk to those people down to engineering school and see what they recommend for you?"
Yeah.
So I wandered down there and talked to the counselors in the engineering school. And the guy says, "Well, what do you want to major in?" I said, "Explain it to him again. I need a piece of paper that says I'm a graduate of college so I can go fly airplanes."
Wow, you had tunnel vision, didn't you?
I did.
Yeah.
I mean, since 2 years old.
Wow. Okay.
So anyway, the guy says, "Oh, man, where do we get these people?"
Okay.
He says, "Well, airplanes have electricity in them. Why don't you go down to the electrical engineering department and tell them you want to be an electrical engineer?"
Okay.
So I did. I went down and said, "I need a degree. Guy says it's got electricity on airplanes. I'd like to get a degree."
Okay.
Because they always got a chuckle out of this. You know?
They also have moving parts, so mechanical would have worked too.
Yeah,
but,
yeah. But as it turns out, all the curricula that I had to take to be an electrical engineer, thermodynamics and vector analysis, all the mathematics and so forth, fit right in with learning how to fly. Because when I got to flight school, I'd had all this stuff. I mean, I knew exactly all the principles of what made things work.
Because when you fly, you have to look at the vector of the wind. You have to look at the direction you're going, how you point your plane, and you have to do all of those vector calculations.
Well,
right?
Yeah. And you got to do it mentally. But I knew how they worked because I studied it in college.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like when you fly along straight and level, in steady state, except you're moving, your thrust is greater than the drag.
Yeah.
Your movement gives you the lift that overcomes gravity.
Yeah.
And if you want to change any of those things, if you increase your angle of bank, you reduce that vector that causes you to balance gravity.
Oh, so you're looking at the force vectors on your plane is one of the things you're looking at. Yeah.
I mean, this is what helped me understand flying better than anything else, especially when it got into air combat maneuvering and so forth and doing – even in bombing, air-to-ground bombing, it made me understand all this stuff. And most people probably never even thought about it, but when you're flying formation, if you have to make a correction, you have to make three corrections. Let's say you're in formation and your airplane starts to accelerate beyond the speed of that other one. You got to pull the power back.
Okay, formation. You mean you're flying next, like the Blue Angels,
yes,
in a way.
Right.
Okay.
You pull the power back because you've already started accelerating beyond faster than this guy. So you got to stop the acceleration, and then you got to back it off to move back into formation, and then you got to add power again to stabilize it. And that occurs with every movement of the airplane. There's three corrections that you always have to make, and you always have to just continually think about all those things.
Wow.
And pretty soon you don't have to think. You know, you program your brain as you just recognize this and you just do it. You know, your motor skills are developed so that you don't have to think, okay, I got to do this, I got to do that. You know, it just happens.
It's got to be almost like a muscle memory in a way.
Well, brain memory.
Brain memory. Right.
And at the same time, you know, you got to have your eyeballs constantly moving because you always got to watch this guy. You got to watch your navigation. You got to be reading your kneeboard and where all your maps and stuff are. And you got to be getting your weapon systems all ready to deliver.
Yeah.
And if it's weather, you know, there's a little thing called vertigo that as soon as you get into weather, if you don't concentrate 100% on your instruments, your brain just flips and says that, I don't know which way's up.
That's the reason pilots have different levels of skill. You have visual flight rules, and then you have instrument flight rules.
Right.
And the instrument flight rules are the ones that let you overcome the vertigo and trust your instruments
exactly.
And not your senses.
And it's just a whole other skill set. But that's the wonder of flight school. I mean, they have systematically, you know, they learned it the hard way as to how to teach people this stuff.
Uh-huh.
Because we had a lot of accidents.
Yeah.
But now they had developed, by the time I was coming along, they had developed the skill sets for instructors that could articulate what you needed to do and what you needed to be thinking about. And since you're going, you know, 360, 400 miles an hour, you got to be thinking 4 to 5 minutes ahead of what's happening right now.
Yeah.
Because that's where you're going to be. And so you got to always be anticipating. It's a wonderful exercise for the brain.
Well, I had an uncle that wanted to be a pilot, and this was back before the Air Force. I think they call it the Army Air Corps or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't let him in because his eyeballs weren't good enough.
Right.
You have to have an incredible sense of sight. You also have to have an incredible ability of reaction. In fact, you have very good sight. And I also know another person that has good sight, and that was Chuck Yeager. I have my heritage in West Virginia, and there they have Chuck Yeager Airfield.
Absolutely.
And it's really funny because they took a mountain. There's no flat places in West Virginia. They took a mountain and they kind of made it flat on top. And boy, when you land in Chuck Yeager Airport, you hit the brakes quick, because if you don't hit the brakes quick enough, you go off the other side of the mountain. But Chuck Yeager was supposed to have these incredible eyeballs.
He did.
And
he was.
You were also blessed with good eyeballs. In fact, if you look at the movies Top Gun and Maverick and Iceman, I think, played by Val Kilmer,
right?
They both had these extraordinary visions. Your name was Hawk, just like a hawk can see for miles and see a speck on an egg, you know,
That's exactly a thousand miles below.
Yeah. And so, what's your eyesight?
Well,
what was your eyesight
been,
and your vision?
20/20 is a normal perfect vision.
Yeah.
And mine would run 20/10, you know, so I could see just a little bit better than the average person.
Okay.
And that plays that's really key, because there's a couple of things that you, again, in flying, you learn these things, but you got to program your brain, because sometimes if you're looking in the cockpit, some people will look out of the cockpit and their eyes don't refocus on infinity, you know, because that's what you got to look at out there, because what you're trying to do is detect any motion of anything out there.
Right, right.
But your eyes have to be focused on infinity to really be able to have the best accommodation of those things. And so it was a skill set that you had to learn, of looking in the cockpit, looking out of the cockpit, and you had to make that transition very quickly. And you had to, at the time, especially when you're in weather, you know, your eyes are constantly moving on all the other instruments, cross-checking everything. You know, and again, I just can't say enough about the flight training that I received in the Navy. You know, one of the things that they used to emphasize time and time and time again, we'd have what they'd put you under a bag, so it was no visual reference to anything. And they would start killing instruments, especially your attitude gyro that gave you your primary focus.
Yeah.
And so you had to go needle ball and airspeed. So you just had three little things.
Okay, needle. Let's go through one at a time.
Okay,
what's the needle?
A needle is an indicator in there that gives you your angle of bank.
Okay.
Okay, the ball is just a ball like a level in the airplane that gives you your slip or your yaw in the airplane.
Gotcha. Right.
Okay. And then, of course, your airspeed and altitude. I didn't say altitude, but you got to constantly look at your altitude, because if it's perceptually starts to move, you're already too late. You got to anticipate those moves. And the way you anticipate that move is there's another instrument we call a vertical speed indicator. And it's a real sensitive instrument. As soon as your vertical speed starts to deviate, it starts to move. And so you got to look at that, and then you got to go back up and cross-check everything else and make sure that every movement that you make all coordinates together to do what you got to do. And don't forget the three movements. So everything you have to do once, you got to do two more times to get it back on. Because if you're, let's say you're starting to sink, now you got to move the nose back up. You got to move the nose back up to stop the sink, and then to get back to where it was. And then when you get back to where it was, you got to have the nose movement to put it back to where it's level.
Gotcha. Again. So you had to do all of this just with those three pieces of instrument.
That's right. And that's why the Navy and the Air Force are so good in teaching it. And simulators have really come a long way to be able to teach you this stuff in a simulator, because it's less expensive than taking an airplane out, and it's not near as dangerous.
Yeah, this is interesting. I used to work with a guy at University of Washington, and his name was Tom Furness. They called him the grandfather of virtual reality. But there's so much great technology that the DOD starts. They started self-driving cars when they had their unmanned races across the U.S. I don't know exactly the course they did. They were the ones that started GPS. They started the internet. And another thing they started was virtual reality. And the purpose of that was for pilots, so that they would have heads-up display.
Yep.
So that you could actually, when I used to smoke, I used to put my cigarettes on the dashboard. And at night, I could see the reflection of it in the window. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of like heads-up display. You see the reflection of all the instruments in the window. And that was a really big thing. And anyway, he was the one that started virtual reality. And also, in terms of the training of the pilot, they put you in this little booth, and it simulates you actually flying. Like you were saying, it saves a lot of money, right?
Oh, yeah.
And
And not only that, they became so sophisticated that not only are you doing what you're doing in relationship to the world, but they got so sophisticated with their computer programs that they could program another fighter or a ship that was moving in the water, and you could go land on the ship and so forth. And so you'd do that stuff before you went out and did it. And so when you got there, it was a piece of cake.
Okay.
Well, not a piece of cake, but you were somewhat familiar with it.
Yeah. The colloquialisms. I had a Korean student. He came with me with a problem. I said, that's a piece of cake. He says, that is not a piece of cake. So we have to be careful with our colloquialisms there. So that's kind of funny. So you started flying the fighter planes. I think you mentioned to me that there was a difference between Army, Navy, and Marine pilots, that they're different breeds. Is that true?
Well, yeah, because of the different cultures of all the services, each of us bring our own methods of war fighting to the program. The Air Force is and this has changed several times over the years, but the Air Force used to be big blue sky stuff, high, go down, shoot down airplanes, and then the primary focus of the Marines and the way we used airplanes was to provide what we call heavier artillery, movable artillery, because it allowed us to locate where the fight was and put bombs on the bad guys really close to where the good guys were.
Oh, okay. So this is like, for example, D-Day, when the two forces were meeting each other, you had to drop bombs on the Nazis and not kill the invaders.
Now that's called, there's three operational terminology that's used. Strategic bombing, operational bombing.
Strategic, operational.
And then tactical bombing.
Tactical, okay.
Okay, tactical bombing is happening right now.
I see.
Operational bombing is what you want had to happen 2 or 3 days from now. And strategic bombing is where you're reaching way out behind the lines and destroying logistical capabilities.
I see.
Of the bad guys.
Okay.
Okay, so the tactical portion is right up close, right next to the troops.
It's right now.
Right now.
Yeah.
And where you got troops that are in combat and you want to put steel on the enemy and destroy him.
Yeah.
Okay. The Marines, we focused on that entirely. That was our whole raison d'etre. Every Marine's a rifleman, and everything that we did as pilots was to support that guy with that rifle. That was our whole mental thought. Anything else we did was fluff. Okay.
So you were a major general in the Marines.
Yes, sir.
Were you an expert with the rifle? All Marines?
I'm going to tell you this, and this is a confession.
Okay. Confession. I should put up a barrier and offer you absolution here.
I did not go to the basic school.
Oh, okay.
Which is where we developed all of our skills and where we got all of our qualifications that we said, okay, you're an expert rifleman, you're a sharpshooter, or you're a marksman. That was the three categories. The need when I got out of flight school was for jet pilots to be in Vietnam. And so basic school is at Quantico, Virginia. That's where all the officers go through to get their 6 months training of how to be a ground officer. I skipped all that because they needed pilots, and they sent us to Vietnam pretty quick.
I see. Okay.
And so I didn't go through all that ground training that some of the other people did. Was I a good shot? Yeah, I was a pretty good shot, but I was never, ever one of those guys that practiced a lot. When I was a kid, I used to shoot squirrels in the eye. Yeah, my dad,
because of your good eyeballs, right?
Yeah. Well, okay. and it's a whole... It's the whole trigger pull thing, the squeeze.
I never thought there is a correlation between being able to shoot a squirrel in the eye and being a good pilot.
You have to
have the motor control for your arms, and you have to have the eyes in order to do the shooting.
My dad used to really fuss at me if I didn't hit him in the eye.
Are you serious?
Serious as a heart attack.
Oh, my gosh. And what kind of rifle did you use?
I had a little J.C. Higgins 22 bolt action.
A 22? Wow. Okay. Bob, I'm really impressed.
I don't be impressed because that was so many years ago. I wish I could replicate that now, but I can't. But that's what happens when we grow older. You know, we have to choose our things that we can do better.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
They don't require so many motor skills.
Exactly. Wow. Okay. Interesting.
But anyway, the whole concept of this thing about the difference between the pilots, Navy guys, their biggest thinking is to protect the fleet. Okay.
Right.
So they have interceptors.
Oh, I see.
And then they use their airplanes to go out and bomb other ships that are threats to the fleet. Okay. But that's where their concentration is. Where ours is on that individual Marine, the Navy is on protecting the fleet.
Yeah.
Now, the Air Force is, they're strategic. You know, that's where the whole concept of—
soften them up behind the lines.
Destroy their little logistics capabilities.
Gotcha.
You know, and do that. Now, let's just take an example. Now, I have some really good friends that are Air Force guys that were A-10 drivers. Now, the A-10 mission—
What is an A-10?
It's a warthog. They call it the warthog. And it's got a 30-millimeter cannon in the front of it. It's a Gatling gun.
Okay.
That shoots about 2,000 rounds a minute of 30-millimeter
depleted uranium. This is on an aircraft.
It's on an aircraft. Okay. The gun itself is about this big around, you know, about 2.5 foot in diameter.
Yeah.
And it's right in the front of the airplane. And it is a tank killer. And it carries lots of bombs. It's a straight-wing airplane, so it's slow. And one of the things that we always talk about in flying fighters is speed is your friend. You know, because when you got speed, you can exchange that energy there for other things. You know, turning, yanking, banking, moving, trying to outmaneuver somebody that's shooting at you.
That's in there. Speed is your friend. Okay.
Yeah. We always said speed is life. Yeah.
Okay.
Whereas the A-10, it's an airplane. It's a slower airplane, but carries lots of bombs, and it's an ideal close air support airplane.
Uh-huh.
And it's terrific. It's a tank killing this machine on Earth today. And the Air Force has been trying to get rid of it because they don't like that mission. But they saw how good and effective it was for the Army, especially in the Iraq War. I mean, that airplane was phenomenal for close air support, and it still is. And you see that they keep trying to get rid of it. Fairchild built the airplane, and they kept trying to get rid of it, and they're still trying to get rid of it. That's because their focus is different. You know, their focus is not primarily close air support. Okay. Now, they're good at it, and they do it, but they do it mostly with the A-10. Does the F-16 have the capability? Yeah. Does the F-15 have the capability? Yeah. But that's not where their focus is. Their focus is at high altitude stuff, killing bad guys or dropping interdiction bombs behind the. You remember in Vietnam, the big thing was the 105s. They call it the Thud. The Thud. Yeah, it was the Thunder Chief. It was the name, but it was called what the Thud was its the little nickname for it. But it was a Mach 2 plus airplane. And it was designed to build a nuclear, to carry a nuclear weapon, to deliver a nuclear weapon behind enemy lines. But when Vietnam started out, we had a lot of Thuds. We had tons of them. So the Air Force used it for strategic bombing up north. And remember, there was a place called Thud Ridge up in North Vietnam.
Yeah.
That was up in Route Package 6. And the Air Force would come in there and get a lot of Thuds shot down because it was not designed for that mission. Because they started hanging racks of bombs on the outside of the airplane,
yeah,
which slowed it down and gave it a less maneuverable capability.
Gotcha.
And so it was more susceptible to SAMs, surface-to-air missiles coming up and hitting it. And you couldn't dodge them as good as you need to. And you couldn't also dogfight as good as you need to with the MiGs.
So, yeah, I was asking you about that. Are there still dogfights?
Well, you know, that's a whole other concept that was probably more fun than anything else you ever did.
Oh, because you consider dogfights fun?
Oh, it's the most exhilarating thing. Well, you talked about the movies Maverick and Top Gun.
Yeah.
You know, you saw the A-4s in there. You saw the F-14s. I used to fly those A-4s at Top Gun all the time. We'd go down and support Top Gun's graduation because we'd provide them dissimilar air.
Okay.
The A-4 Skyhawk was very similar in maneuverability to the MiG-21, except we had a better roll rate. But ours was 720 degrees per second. You can do two aileron rolls in a second.
What's an aileron roll?
Well, just flip it over twice.
Oh, okay.
And you just go full stick, and you go pew, pew. You'd turn 360 degrees twice in 1 second.
Okay, while you were moving forward and
right. Wow. And but the MiG, and that's how we could do better in a lot of the dogfights than the MiG, because the MiG was slow as well. And if a MiG got behind you for some reason, we could turn and yank, and the MiG could not turn quick enough to keep in phase with us. And then as he starts coming around again, you whip and go back this way, and he's here. And pretty soon, you're back behind him. Two or three turns.
So you're using the capabilities of your enemy, the lack of capabilities.
The lack of capability. That's what dogfighting is all about. But let me say this. Today, mostly, it's all beyond visual range. Our missile technology has increased so much that you don't find that the engagements are like the old-time dogfights in World War I and World War II and in Korea and in Vietnam. You know, because now our missile capability is so far advanced that you can have a guy behind you, you can pick him up on your radar, you can launch a missile, that missile will leave, go forward, and go back.
Go right over your head.
Yeah.
It'll go forward and over kill your head and get,
and kill him.
Get him behind you.
Yeah. Now, see, wow. We didn't have that capabilities with missiles before.
Yeah.
But, and now, you know, the old.
But they have that capability also, don't they?
Yes. Yes. I don't think theirs is quite as good as ours.
Okay.
But they're developing it pretty rapidly. Some of their, and again, a whole other technology development that's changed the face of warfighting, especially in aviation, is the stealth. Because now, it's harder for the bad guys to pick up you.
All the stealth technology.
Because the radar hasn't caught up with the capability of you to be stealthful. You know, and that's a design issue. It's a skin issue, how they develop a...
I actually did research on that, by the way.
Oh,
the stealth bombers, first of all, they have flat. They have flat sides.
Right.
And the reason for that is because the reflection is more like a mirror as opposed to a scattering, which goes in all directions.
Yeah.
The other thing was the absorb, and this is what we worked on. Artificial intelligence was actually designing the dielectric coating of the wings so that there was more absorption than there was reflection.
That's correct.
And this was really interesting technology.
Yeah.
So that's...
And they had some issues with it. You remember the B-2, it was at the Whiteman Air Force Base. When it would get in the rain, it would kind of degrade the capability of the skin to disperse radar.
Oh, I never thought of that. That's right. Because the water got on it, screwed up the dielectric, and it didn't operate as designed. Okay.
Because that was a real weakness to start with. But I think they've gone a long way because, the F-35s are that way. The F-22s have got all this sophisticated stuff. Their design is such that they're just really, really difficult to pick up by radar. But again, their radar is getting better and better and better, as is ours.
Uh-huh.
But then as soon as you have to launch a weapon, whether it's opening the bomb bay doors to drop a bomb out of it or to open up a compartment to let a missile go out of it, you're exposing more of a radar signature. And so that's why now they do it very quickly. They that thing goes out of there quicker than you can bat down and closes it back up. So if they get you with one sweep, then you close back up and you disappear again.
That's fascinating.
I mean, it is fascinating. But right now, from a perspective on the fifth generation airplanes that are out there now, dogfighting is sort of secondary. It's something that you nice to know how to do.
Technology is
taken over.
But
you pray that you never have to do it.
Yeah.
Because you don't want it. You have the capability to reach out and touch them before you ever see them.
Let me ask you this. This is kind of a new topic, but Elon Musk, who is a
genius
entrepreneur.
Incredible.
A friend of mine at Discovery Institute, George Gilder, said he's a great entrepreneur, but he's a retarded thinker. he thinks, for example, that we are simulations. At least this was a previous understanding of what we are. We're simulations, much like a computer simulation of a human being. And there's other sort of strange things. But I think he has some great ideas. I don't know if we're ever going to make it to Mars. That's going to be really great if we are able to do that. But if you look at his accomplishments with Tesla and SpaceX and X now, the platform, and one of the greatest names for a company, the Boring Company, which is the one that make tunnels. What a great name for a company, the Boring Company.
Yeah.
But anyway, he came out, and this
was
recently. Which
hasn't been too successful, by the way.
It hasn't been successful?
No, because see, they were doing that. They were going to put that all underground from that high-speed train from Los Angeles to San Francisco.
Right, right.
And they've spent billions of dollars on that, and
it still ain't working.
It ain't out of the box yet.
Okay. Well, we'll see what happens to the Boring Company. But one of the things that Musk said is that the current fighter planes, he was talking about, I think, the F-35s, they cost about $100 million each. That's the current price of them. And he said, really, with the advent of drone technology, that maybe we should be spending our money on drones instead of fighter planes. Do you have any opinions about that?
I have opinions about it, but I don't have the technical expertise to explain to you exactly what my thinking is versus what reality is. Because what we as human beings always think about is we feel like we're infallible and we're necessary as part of any machine to make it work to its peak. But when you start thinking about the human resource requirements in an airplane, the weight that it costs, the space that it costs, can you exchange that for some other technology that would make the plane better?
Yeah.
Now, the thing that we always think about, and I think about this all the time, is from a pilot perspective, I always think that I've got to be in control. Now, when you put drones in control, somewhere somebody's controlling something.
Well, I think the drones are still under manual control. It's just that they're
you
they're
saved all that weight
playing a playing a video game.
Yeah, you've saved all that weight in the airplane. You've saved all that space in the airplane. Yeah, you don't have to now. You don't have to build a cockpit that can look out. It can be a.
You don't have to worry about G forces.
That's right.
Which was a big thing in the movie Maverick that I took issue with.
Yeah, well, and it's still a big deal. You know, and the F-16 was such a capable airplane. You know, you could out G your body very quickly.
Did you ever feel the effects of that while you were flying?
Oh, yeah. I mean, but the thing is, the airplanes that I flew, they never had those kind of capabilities of over-G-ing your airplane. What the airframe itself would reach limits before your human body did.
Right, gotcha.
But then the more sophisticated that they got and the speed increased with the F-16s and the F-15s and so forth, you could the airframe would outperform what the body could take.
Gotcha. Interesting. So one of the things that's always worried me about drones, I used to worry that if you had 1,000 drones coming at you, what could you do? You would have to come up with some autonomous cannon to shoot them, bang, 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 bang. Then somebody pointed out that if there was an EMP from a nuclear explosion, that fries all the electronics. So if you're being
everything.
On everything. And everything. But the military now, Russia and China and the United States have what I would call an EMP cannon, which is an EMP focus that can actually be focused on a swarm of drones. And it strikes me that this is just like bug spray, that you would go shh, and all of those drones would fall out of the sky because they would all be fried. Now, the people that are in favor of the drones come along and they say, well, we can harden them. But if they harden them, that's going to take that's going to be more weight. And so there's going to be
there's trade-offs in everything you do.
Yeah, there's trade-offs, and there's always this.
But we're getting into an area that's pretty classified at this point.
Oh, you think so?
Oh,
I imagine that's true. Okay, Bob, we've been going for quite a while, so let's call this off. But I want to continue, because next time I want to talk about some of your work at the Pentagon and some of the things you did there. And I think it's very interesting because you were really an advocate for people in the reserve, and you also had some challenges with your faith, and I wanted to talk about that too. That to me is very fascinating. We've been talking to United States Marine Major General Bobby Hollingsworth about his life and experience, and it's fascinating, and we'll continue next podcast. Until then, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters News with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.